alarm about this, partly because they point out that the Department of Homeland Security is often the U.S. government office that purchases ethically and legally questionable technology and is able to circumvent a lot of scrutiny by arguing that they have a law enforcement national security basis for using it. So you now have a perfect storm, Amy, of technology of this type that's really powerful and really easily abused in the hands of the U.S. government, again, under the Biden administration. The Biden administration has, in response to reporting on this just recently, paused that contract. They say they're reviewing it. But the thing is, right around the corner, the Trump administration is coming in, and we can talk about this, but obviously the Trump administration is bringing in a raft of officials and Trump himself who have made explicit threats against the groups that, again and again, in Western democracies, have been most vulnerable to this kind of espionage.
That's Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Ronan Farrow and Matthew O'Neill talking about their new documentary, Surveil, that airs tonight at 9 on HBO, is streaming at Max. We'll link to Ronan's New Yorker article, The Technology the Trump Administration Could Use to Hack Your Phone. We'll talk more about that with him tomorrow. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Ready for another year of grassroots community radio? With your support, it's possible. Go to kboo.fm/give or mail a check to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214 to contribute to KBOO's $75,000 goal for our Catalog of Connections year-end campaign, going now until December 31st. What better way to celebrate than by giving your loved one a KBOO membership this season?
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. KBOO's Community Advisory Board will meet on Monday, December 9th at 6 p.m. The meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 8:02 a.m. Next up is Wednesday Talk Radio with Paul Rowland.
In the sky, city's aflame in the summertime. No. Listen, gun control, the sound of soul. Shooting rockets to the moon. Kids growing up too soon. Politicians say more taxes will solve everything.
And the band played on.
Rising fast, the Beatles' new records of gas.
And the only safe place to live is on an Indian reservation.
And the band played on.
Eve of destruction, tax deduction.
City inspectors, bill collectors.
All growth in the name, population out of hand.
Suicide, too many bills, hippies moving to the hill. People all over the world are shouting in the world.
Band played on.
Hey, Kooka, Kooka, can't you hear me talking to you?
Set the ball in the field.
Yeah, indeed. Ball of confusion. That's what the world is today. Oh, boy. Good morning, everybody. I'm Paul Rowland. I'm with you till 9 o'clock. I'm looking forward to hearing from you. I'm here by myself, not 503-231-8187. Yeah, that song from 1970. There are a few notes of things a little bit out of date there. And I always did take issue that the only safe place to live is on an Indian reservation. I think that came from a place of relative ignorance. But anyway, and then hippies moving to the hills, not so much. Anyway, yes, we are indeed in a world full of confusion, strife, war. And that sound of that song just really kind of hits it for me. So anyway, I thought I'd lead off with that. We can talk about the ball of confusion. I would like to talk about some themes I've been going at, maybe with a bit of a different angle, read you some articles, and also wait for your calls. So can we actually understand what's happening in the world? I know that seems like a simplistic question. I know I've talked the different ways of understanding the world, political education, blah, 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 lots of things. But can we understand what's happening in the world? Do some people understand it better than others? That's important because, sometimes we just don't have the time to put into trying to understand, because it's complicated, folks. A history of colonization and imperialisms and capitalist development, just mind-boggling technological development that we are so immersed in, as you heard on that last segment on Democracy Now! Surveilled. I don't know. I've gone back and forth. I've thought, maybe I should get a smartphone. Everybody's got a smartphone. I'm out there in the city, trying to find some place. I didn't write the address down. I thought I knew. And it'd be so easy just to look it up on the internet. Google Maps, GPS, all that stuff. But I think right now I'm sticking with my flip phone, especially with, as you said at the very end there, with a new administration coming in with all this talk about the FBI appointee, said he wanted to abolish the FBI. They're not going to abolish the FBI. They're going to go after us, folks. us. They're going to go after the people who they see as the most serious threats. Anyway, so, yeah, that's a little aside. So do some people understand better than others? Can understanding it help us deal with what's happening? That's a big one. Are some worldviews better than others for understanding what's going on and for helping to deal with it? So those are big questions. I know it's early in the morning. People are running around, going to work, getting their kids off to school maybe, or I don't know, getting breakfast, just lying in bed still, whatever you're doing at work already. But maybe it's not the best time to have a talk show where you try to talk about deep things. You know, a lot of people just want to hear what people have to say and, you know, take it in. Anyway, I do like to stimulate in-depth conversations. So anyway, does KBOO help understand what's going on in the world? That's a big one. Does KBOO have a role? You know, I know we're less and less of the media market, since you got social media and you sliced up so many different ways, bewildering number of options. Yeah, the world's changed, but we're still here. And, you know, we still got some attention, but, you know, we need some love, folks. We are in our end of the year membership drive. And if you do really feel like KBOO is useful, is inspirational, is a nice distraction, provides good music, whatever you value in KBOO, we do need your love, folks. We are getting off to a bit of a slow start with our end of the year membership drive. We've got a $75,000 goal, and we need to move right along. So if you do believe that KBOO helps you frame what's happened in the world better, gives you kind of information that you don't get from other sources, then please go to kbo.fm/give. This is the season of giving, as it were. If you are able to, if you have the means, you have the wherewithal and the disposition, please don't delay. Go to kboo.fm, click on that donate button, or you can text KBOO to 44321 on your mobile device. Please do that now. Don't wait any longer. We need to get this off to a good rousing start. Just inspire us all here at KBOO to keep on going and doing what we're doing. All right, we'll take a little bit more about that. Well, so wasn't that something about the South Korea's ever so brief martial law attempt that got rescinded fairly immediately as the leader of Korea realized it wasn't going to happen. Let me just read this text, though. I got a gallows humor post on Facebook saying, you might want to pin this to the fridge door. We'll probably be seeing some similar martial law to protect democracy order here in the next few months. Ha, ha, ha. To protect liberal democracy and safeguard the safety of citizens from the threat of anti-state forces operating within the Republic of Korea, the following measures are hereby declared across the entire nation, effective from 11 p.m. on December 3. All political activities, including the operation of the National Assembly and local councils, political party activities, political associations, assemblies, and demonstrations are prohibited. Any acts that deny or seek to overthrow the liberal democratic system, as well as the dissemination of fake news, manipulation of public opinion, and false propaganda are prohibited. All media and publications will be subject to the control of the martial law command. Strikes, slowdowns, and assemblies that incite social unrest are prohibited, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, well, we'll see. Are we going to see something like martial law? But are we actually going to have enough of a challenge to the incoming Trump administration to elicit a martial law? I mean, not that I'm saying that's our goal, is to elicit martial law, believe me. But hey, you know, people always said that, you know, the people were, you know, back in the day, when there was rampant suppression of resistant movements in this country, when hasn't there been, but people would say, you know, people, it was kind of a badge of honor to be surveilled by the FBI or whatever. But it's so much more sophisticated now, though. It's so much more devious. Anyway, so that's something I wanted to put out there. And I wanted to read, well, I just want to kind of get a little deeper into it. What is going on? I've been looking up, reading up about late stage capitalism. It's apparently the last few years there's been a big upsurge in discussion of late stage capitalism as people, the after effects of the Great Recession and trying to understand Trumpism. You know, because we do focus a lot on individuals and personalities, you know, on Trump, on Harris as a person, on Biden as a person, on, you know, his cognitive capacities, all of which are important because there is an inner, is part of the intersectionality of things. Individual personalities do, you know, interact with the systems in which we are immersed and generally kind of constrained and socialized by. But they are important, but they're not necessarily as important as those systems themselves. So understanding the systems does seem to be rather important. I get the feeling that there still is a general resistance to really go deep into understanding what the nature of capitalism actually is. It's the water we swim in, the air we breathe, that it just kind of prevents us. We're propagandized into it. We're conditioned into it, socialized into it from the very get-go. So getting enough distance from it, that's why the Marxist tradition has been so valuable, because it actually does, it names the mechanisms of the capitalist system. It tries to outline a history of how the capitalist system developed out of feudalism, et cetera, and what makes it different, what makes it tick, and how it's developed. There's been evolution, mutations of the capitalist system, as the ability to make profit on the existing ways of making profit tend to slow down and dry up. The ever newer ways, new technologies, new sources of capital. Of course, technological development is huge in that. The ability to manipulate the natural world, to process things, to manufacture things, to commoditize things. Commodify is the word. I do think there is, there used to be much more of a tradition of understanding public discussion of capitalism, that there's signs that it's coming back, but to some extent we kind of lost that thrust, that the impetus that came out of the Marxist tradition, and it's hard to get that back once it's been so thoroughly, I'll say it, defeated, really. So I wanted to talk about this article that I came across. Let's see, where is it? It's about China and the United States and solidarity against imperialisms. Okay, I'm just pulling it up on my handy Counterpunch website. Anyway, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. Having a bit of a hard time finding that right now. So Anyway, the thrust of it is that the nature of the sorry, pardon me. I'm just going to go back to the beginning here. I'm going to go this Nation article. I was talking about late-stage capitalism. What Explains Trumpism? It's Capitalism and It's Global by Stephen Crowley from November 25. There are many problems with the American political system, the Electoral College, an undemocratic Senate, and a right-wing Supreme Court among them. Then there's America's deep racism combined with sexism and xenophobia. But Trumpism goes beyond Trump and extends beyond the borders, walled or not, of the United States. The phenomenon of right-wing populism is wide-ranging, appearing in far-right parties in Western Europe, in Orbán's Hungary and Putin's Russia, Erdogan's Turkey, Bolsonaro's Brazil, and Modi's India. While country-level traits can help us understand individual cases, when the same phenomenon repeats itself, a higher level of analysis is needed. The one thing these varied countries share is that they are all deeply embedded in the global capitalist economy. With the ascent of capitalist globalization, beginning in the Reagan-Thatcher era, or even with Jimmy Carter's deregulation, well, I'd say it goes back to the origins of capitalism itself, but hyper-globalization, maybe you call it, national governments became less and less capable of shaping outcomes that could positively impact the lives of their citizens. Capital became global, seeking lower taxes, less regulation, and cheaper wages. Financial markets followed the whims of fluctuating interest rates and currencies across the world. Well, and new pools of capital, like the dot, you know, like the tech, the high tech, and, you know, all kinds of fossil fuel expansions, et cetera, et cetera. In short, the economy became global, but politics did not. The vessel of national politics could no longer contain the forces that were central to people's daily lives, such as well-paying jobs and a decent standard of living. Elections would take place, governments come and go, but for many people there was little sense of meaningful change. As a result, trust in public institutions has dropped precipitously worldwide. Yet the anguish was not shared equally. Capital flowed into global cities, drawing in educated professionals, with other places left behind to deal with deaths of despair. The parties of the center-left followed the new centers of gravity toward urban professionals. But in the game of electoral politics, they failed to protect their flank. Little wonder, then, about the appeal of nationalism, the desire to take back control and make our country great again. Meloni and Le Pen aside, these would-be autocrats are all male. Their appeal can partly be explained by the relative decline of, especially less educated, men in increasingly post-industrial societies. But the strong man also projects a sense of muscular protection against forces that appear to be out of control. By its nature, global capitalism is a mysterious phenomenon, one without an address or figurehead. Conspiracies provide a coherent narrative, a sense of understanding and comprehension over otherwise amorphous forces shaping one's life. Most often, they address a vexing question: who is to blame? The strong men provide a ready answer, yet whether they are self-proclaimed billionaires like Trump or rely on the backing of oligarchs, their storyline must solve the conservative dilemma. How, in societies with even just a veneer of democracy, do conservatives convince people to support policies that benefit the uber-wealthy? The strong man's tactic is simple: punch down, place the blame on immigrants, on ethnic, religious, and sexual minorities. You might blame an amorphous elite, but never the capitalist class. While Elon Musk was literally dancing for Trump, and Jeff Bezos apparently pulled the endorsement of his Washington Post to avoid alienating the presumed future president, one study found that 150 billionaire families contributed close to $2 billion to sway elections this year. They've already received a dramatic return on their investment, the wealth of the world's 10 richest people, a list dominated by U.S. tech billionaires, increased by $64 billion on the single day after Trump's election. Still, although 72% of all billionaire funding flowed to Republicans, a larger number of billionaires backed Harris over Trump. What better illustration is there of the oligarchic capture of our politics? For whom do you vote if you believe that billionaires themselves are the problem? There's little prospect that capitalism, especially in its global form, will come to an end anytime soon. Without guardrails, capitalism will continue to run amok, trampling our politics and poisoning our planet. For that to change, the oligarchs of the world need to realize that capitalism without limits will devour themselves along with the rest of us. Well, now, I don't know, they're going in the direction of of saying that it's the oligarchs that need to somehow change, and the idea that that's the problem. It is so vast, and it is so complex, and it is so omnipresent that the idea of actually ending the capitalist system strikes us as absurd, or it's just doesn't enter our consciousness. Anyway, I see someone's trying to call in. 503-231-8187, that's the number. I've kind of come to the in a study of oligarchic rule in a variety of societies across history, Jeffrey Winters found that the one element they shared was the overriding desire to defend their wealth. Today's oligarchs must be reminded that they stand on the top of human pyramids, propped up by masses of people who bear immense weight on their backs and shoulders. Anyway, yeah, he's going in the direction of, we have to convince oligarchs that they need to, that their self-interest depends on their sharing the wealth. Okay, I mean, better that, of course, than total absolute destruction, which is where we're headed. But, I personally haven't given up on the idea that some kind of larger scale challenge to the capitalist system is still a possibility, not completely off the table. Okay, so I discovered why I was floundering on the air trying to find that Counterpunch article. Because when I tried to get it, it said uBlock origin has prevented the following page from loading off of Counterpunch. That's on my KBOO computer here, which is really weird. Never had that happen, but I did have it up already on my laptop, which is right here. So I actually can get to that, because I think it's really important. Although Marx did say the task is not to understand history, but to change it, which I also agree with, still, you have to understand it in order to be able to change it. So here we are. Looks like we have a caller. I just want to, before we get to Santiago, I know Santiago, you call in a lot, which is great, and I do want to get to you. But building international solidarity against imperial rivalry. And I know this is something we'll want to talk about. So hang on, Santiago. And other people get on stack, 503-231-8187. Okay, increasingly, understanding the inter-imperialist competition between the United States and China is becoming essential to understanding the dynamics of the modern capitalist system. With the goal of broadening our understanding of the dynamics at play, Ashley Smith, along with co-authors Eli Friedman, Kevin Lin, and Rosa Liu, have published China and Global Capitalism, Building International Solidarity Against Imperial Rivalry, out now from Haymarket Books. Thomas Hummel recently sat down with Ashley Smith. Anyway, so there's a conversation. So my take, before we go to our first caller, Santiago, is that imperialism, capitalism, industrialism, and technology are all separate but interrelated things. So if back in the 60s, the line from the Beatles song, you ain't gonna, if you go going around carrying pictures of Chairman Mao, you ain't gonna make it with anyone anyhow. I was kind of like that, because there's all these sectarian communist or socialist groups, that followed Mao's line or were, whatever. And I was more into more of a homegrown, socialist, anarchist, theoretical construct based upon our own experiences within the global history and understanding the global economic social dynamics. But I believe that imperialism is much older than capitalism. Capitalism developed out of imperialism and colonialism, but it's not the same thing. And I think imperialism is much older and much more deeply rooted in our societies. Anyway, I just wanted to hopefully get back to this article a bit later. This is a really important article. Okay, let's hear what you have to say. Go ahead, Santiago.
Good morning. And just a quick aside, when you read Mao's writings, he says essentially what you're saying. He's like, you can't do what I'm doing because you don't live in the same conditions as me, and you're not dealing with the same things as me. So you have to be the one to analyze your material conditions and find out the best way for you. You know, he encouraged everybody to like read his writings because, you know, he felt like he had some good ideas, but at the end of the day, we have to look at our own material conditions to find our best way out. But
and what is all that? Well, just to follow up there real quick, maybe you're going there, but then, you know, there's also the dynamic that things mutate and change within the system that he helped create, and it may develop its own terrible contradictions that he doesn't necessarily realize or have much control over. Anyway.
Well, I mean, but the thing is that that's all a part of the unity of opposites. You know, it's like you were talking about how it's evolution, but a proper understanding of the law of contradictions and a proper understanding of like a historical materialism gives us the shears to prune the garden, because ultimately capitalists prune capitalism because capitalism had many mutations before we sit atop the liberal democracy that we have now. It didn't come all in one piece, and neither will socialism, but we have to be active participants in it, is what I was trying to get at. And that's where understanding our material conditions and being able to move in those correct directions is how we get to the things that we want, like you're talking about.
So one problem with that I have with the way some people present, you know, a Marx. Whoa, that was loud.
Well, yeah, sorry about that. Go ahead.
there's a certain jargon that happens when people discuss, because you have to have a language to understand the nature of reality, because it mystifies itself by its working. So, you know, you have to name it. And the problem is that some of it, the jargon can be kind of alienating or can be mystifying to people because they don't have the basis to understand. So what do you mean by material conditions?
Well, material conditions is essentially like what's going on around you. It's talking about like the Black Panthers pointed that out when they were discussing the formation of their party. They were like, because Huey P. Newton and Eldridge Cleaver argued about that, because Huey P. Newton wanted to use all the fancy jargon that Engels and Marx were using. But he's like, no, none of these cats are going to understand that, man. We got to talk about, we're not the proletariat. We're the, you know, we're the workers. You know, the lump and proletariat is just the brothers around the way. You know, we have to read it and develop our own jargon. But it's up to those who are the vanguard, the backbone, to be able to do that. And unfortunately, you know, there's going to be issues, because ultimately we're all trying to deconstruct from this capitalist hellscape that we've been brought up in. And so, I mean, there's going to be issues. I mean, look, Eldridge Cleaver eventually became like a radical, like, right winger. You know, after it was all said and done, it doesn't mean that his contributions to leftist action are null and void. But it's understanding that without a proper anchor, you know, anybody can, even the smartest among us, even those who are the most dedicated to the cause, can become a part of the things we're fighting against just by sheer laziness.
Right, but you didn't necessarily answer the question about material conditions. I mean, specifically, what are we talking about?
Okay, so we're talking about like who are our political leaders in the area? You know, we're talking about like what is the median wage for workers in the area? What is how much are people paying for their medication? You know, what is the history of the town that you live in? Who were the main players who got the town started? What was their ideology in putting things forward? Because all of these are inherent in what we're dealing with. And it's not this, that, or the other. It's that this, that, and the other are all happening at the same time. So we have to use things like that, stuff that feels mundane oftentimes, and we have to put that all into what scientists would call a working model that shows, that doesn't just show this or that or this in separate models, but shows how it all works together in one piece. So it material conditions is just what's going on around you at the moment. You know, and recognizing that, you know, the material conditions or, you know, the way things are currently is different now in 2024 than it was in 1964 or 1974 or 1984. You know, the idea of, a qualitative, you know, there's qualitative change and quantitative change. You know, we've been going through qualitative changes in the atmosphere for over 100 years, and now we're at the place where we can no longer affect quantitative change because it's changed the quality. Now we're just having to resist the feedback rather than preventing the feedback, if that makes sense. So I mean,
we got other callers,
but what I was going to say real quick, because I didn't mean to get down that rabbit hole, but I guess we went there. You know, the words that people are using, like a lot of liberals are really hip on the new lingo. Ones that I've heard lately are kakistocracy and technocracy, or whatever you want to call it. And it's really just trying to put a buffer between the system that we live in that's causing the problem and trying to make it seem as if it's like these little rogue groups of people who are making the problem. And it is part of it, but you can't, but at the end of the day, like, it's capitalism. It's not, because like you were saying, there's a whole bunch of separate pieces that make the imperialism that we have work. But it's not, we have to call it what it is. And there's a lot of liberals out there, even the most well-meaning, who want to believe that, you know, that the system we have is fine. It just needs some tweaking. And you got to remind people that we've already tried that. It was called Keynesianism, which was a part of the New Deal, which, as racist and as terrible as it was for black and brown folks, it made a lot of really good incremental changes all around. But even the business class that we have to deal with was not in favor of the Keynesianism, because at the end of the day, they don't want to pay any more money than they feel like they have to people who they deem as worthless.
All right. Well, I think we have to let give space for some other people. This is a continuing conversation.
No problem.
Thank you. Always good to hear from you. I just wanted to throw in, sometimes it's helpful to just list the basic building blocks: private property, the ability then to, you know, to buy and sell and to make profit off of private property, the ability to rent private property, to be able to to charge interest on property. Money is just a form of property. So stocks, bonds, interest, profit, rent, these are the basic mechanisms, you know, which are historical developments which did not exist at the dawn of history, that they are inventions of certain people, and arose out of, you know, the empires that formed, you know, the Assyrian, Sumerian, Roman, Greek, blah blah blah, and those morphed into what became the Holy Roman Empire, and that kind of broke down into the different feudal families who owned, you know, they owned everything. And then people were at the grace of the Lord, lived where they didn't, had to pay, you know, a tithe to the church and a portion of their produce to the Lord. And then, you know, with the development of money out of the mid-late Middle Ages, money became more important. Anyway, and, you know, rent originated out of that, the feudal lords' control. But it's because they controlled it. They owned it, controlled it. And that goes way back. You know, it didn't always, wasn't always that way. Anyway, so that's I'm always, so we got another caller. Excuse me. If Mark is still patiently waiting, go ahead, Mark, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I appreciate Santiago's wisdom. And I thank you for reading that article from The Nation. Very insightful. To me, there are two insights that we've gained in civilization. One, that the economy must be embedded in society, and society must not be embedded in the economy. and that somehow the state or politics has to control or moderate the economy. The economy cannot control politics. Now, I know.
But wait a second. But that's a much later stage of everything.
Well, I mean, this is a Keynesian idea.
Right. But before, you know, we didn't used to have, I mean, the idea, you know, we used to have a different kind of culture. You know, I think,
whether we have a culture at all is debatable.
Well, no. Let me just throw out this and we can have a discussion or not. So I think the problem, one of the big problems is we're everything is so normalized, or, you know, like I said, the air we breathe, you know, the idea of civilization itself. I don't even know exactly what you mean by what civilization, lessons from civilization. Civilization is basically, for me, the process of growing empires. To me, that's what civilization is. And they grew out of something that came before that I consider our birthright as Homo sapiens on the planet. And, you know, it seems totally atavistic and seems almost
preposterous. To me, it's preposterous to call Trump a transactionalist. Uh-huh. there are two metaphors that are helpful to me in understanding Trump, that a fly that falls into our soup or a gorilla that rages through our China shop. These are very helpful to me. Now, I wanted to recommend two articles.
Wait a second. You see, gorilla and China shop, you see, that strikes me as
just trashing the rule of law and Department of Education, the human rights of migrants.
Yeah, but what do you got against gorillas, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Oh, I'm sorry. Maybe I made a mistake. I should have said a bear, an enraged bear.
They're so not like it's so not like other animals. What makes humans different? I don't mean to be get too deep into this, but I think our metaphors are really telling. Why do you use metaphors of other animals when we act so different? The problem is that we are actually so different. We are a different kind of a species because of our historical socialization. Anyway,
can I recommend two articles? Sure. One by George Parker in The Atlantic on democratic delusions. He compares George W. Bush 20 years ago with Trump. Now, Bush was reelected narrowly, and he pretended to have a mandate to privatize Social Security. And this failed. Month after month, his popularity failed. His popularity fell. So there are remarkable similarities that could give us opportunities.
Okay.
Now, the other article is titled No Time for Truth by Joseph Beall, and it's in this website, thephilosophicalsalon.com. And let me just quote a couple sentences. History has stopped, Orwell says. Nothing exists except an endless present in which the party is always right. He does not mean that the party always comes up with the correct policy or perspective, but that without any memory of the past, without any fixed standard of comparison, whatever the party says at any given moment is all the truth there is.
Okay, we got other callers.
Okay,
always,
well, I
thank
hope
you for that.
Check this out.
Okay. always impossible, very difficult to have a conversation with me, for one, because I keep taking things to different levels, but also to try to stay focused on one thread and keeping in mind the complexities of everything. Anyway, we got another caller, but let me just read the first part of this article because I think it's really important. Mike, hold on, and the next caller, hold on, please. This is Ashley Smith from this article on building international solidarity against imperial rivalry. And she says, I believe the starting point for any discussion of world politics today is the state of global capitalism, which I think is in its greatest period of crisis since the 1970s and possibly since the 1930s. While it's not on the scale of the Great Depression, Since the Great Recession, we've been in what David McNally has referred to as a long global slump. Michael Roberts calls it a long depression. This crisis is interwoven with other systemic crises, the most obvious being the climate crisis, the migration crisis, which stems from the Great Recession, climate change, and other large-scale issues, and the rising levels of interstate conflict, inter-imperial rivalry, and war. These factors are driving millions of people to move across the globe. On top of this, we're seeing the return of pandemics. COVID-19 is just one of many to come, given the world's increasing integration and the zoonotic spillover of diseases from animals to humans. Anyway, to really get into it, at the same time these crises have intensified inter-imperial rivalries and interstate conflicts, leading to an increasing number of wars, both between states and within states in the form of civil wars. Anyway, I'm not going to be able to read this whole thing. Go to Counterpunch yesterday, Building International Solidarity Against Imperial Rivalry, if you're interested. Okay, let's go to Mike. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, can you all hear me?
Yep.
Great. You know, every now and then I call because these conversations are they're coming down to a head here with what's going on in the world. And if you guys notice, you know, Trump has been talking about a strategic reserve dealing with Bitcoin. And this is something that's very important because, you know, the fiat system is the cause for pretty much all recent wars and the continuance of these wars, because you cannot just engage in war without expending capital. And since they can print it out of thin air, the wars just keep going. So what's happening on the back end, and this is something that has been brewing for the last 14 years, is this system called Bitcoin is a decentralized way of conserving capital, you know, where everybody can participate. Basically, what Trump will be doing is killing the fiat system. As you can tell, there's a corporation called MicroStrategy right now that's taking advantage of this. What they're doing is that they're diluting their shares. And
so you think Trump is going to solve all the world's problems by ending?
No, Trump is not. No, he's actually. This is the part that's interesting. Whether he likes it or not, this is going to happen. The decentralization, you know, just like the church and state got separated.
So you think Bitcoin's going to solve all the world's problems?
It's going to solve a tremendous amount because fiat is the basis for most of our problems.
So how are we going to make all these bitcoins without just like artificial intelligence is doing, without exponentially increasing the use of energy, which is feeding climate change? You think that's going to solve climate change, Bitcoin?
The misunderstanding of Bitcoin's energy consumption is at the root of many people's. Well, and it's interesting that people will start thinking in that sense, but Bitcoin uses energy at its cheapest price. And the way that you can use that energy is by using...
But price has nothing to do with it. It has to do with the absolute use of it. Anyway, so, okay, you said your piece, so you think Bitcoin is going to solve a lot of problems. Thank you for that.
It will solve a tremendous, if not most of the problems.
Okay.
And the United States right now is getting into... follow the money.
Okay.
Follow the money, and you'll see what's happening.
All right.
It's a very interesting proposition. Because
thank you.
You can.
Okay. All right. Well, that's an interesting thing. I unfortunately don't have enough savvy on to be able to argue the point of as he calls it, fiat currency, the current currency system, and it takes a kind of a thinker that is more on their toes than me. Anyway, so let's go to our next caller. Joe, you are on the air.
Hey, good morning, Paul. Great discussion this morning. I kind of started in a little late, so I don't know everything Santiago said, but I heard you talking about the continued relevance of Marx and for like our discussions of the world we live in. And I know Mark, and I felt like calling in after hearing him kind of say that this idea of the economy needs to be embedded in society and not vice versa, because for one thing, it's not Keynesianism. That's from Carl Polanyi's Great Transformation, that basic idea of how market society kind of arose as this independent agency in society. But, you know, touching on your advocacy of Marx as like a great guide to the perplexing world we live in, that the fact that we think of the economy and society as separate things is, whether we embed one, we talk about it as being embedded in one or the other, is kind of an ideological mystification. And Marx, one of Marx's kind of like great insights is that the economy is not like an independent sort of agency or set of laws or processes. It is society, and it's society all the way down. And it's kind of the way in which we become bamboozled by thinking that it has its own priorities and it deserves certain things and it should be treated kind of like a god, that we reify it and we kind of give it that power, whether we're trying to kind of control it for our own purposes or not. And that the idea of kind of the communist revolution overthrowing the state of the world, which is capitalism, has to do with kind of like recognizing what David Graeber posthumously is being remembered for in his new book of essays, The Ultimate Hidden Truth of Everything or the World, which is that all of these things that are happening to us or that seem to happen to us in the name of the economy or whatever are the result of decisions that are actively made, processes that are actively maintained, and that we are the actors in that. But we are alienated from that power, from that actual activity, because of how this complex bamboozling system works. And it's an important touch point to always kind of bring up, because the way that ideology kind of masks over how we talk about the so-called real world is really penetrating. It's you know, a mental, I can't say the word on air, but it's worth remembering that there is no such thing as the economy. The economy is a idea, and it is an idea that we have given life that we need to take back because it's our life.
So at this juncture, I would invite you to join me, Joe, since I know you've been involved in KBOO as well. And I neglected to I got caught up in the heat of the conversations and didn't invite our listeners once again to join in our end of the year membership drive. I do want to pick up the thread of what you're saying, but since I did miss the last opportunity to do that, maybe we could talk a little bit about why we think that, you know, we're getting off, as I said, to a bit of a slow start, and we've been in a bit of a crunch in terms of financing here at KBOO, and these are realities. You know, these are realities that we have to reckon with in the media landscape, the social landscape, and I don't want to get into the too much into the the fear factor of, you know, why we are so important as we move into a Trump administration, but it's a reality. So, you know, with the possible threat of, using this law that they still want to pass to take away nonprofit status from so-called terrorist supporting organizations. So I don't know, you got into KBOO how long ago?
I got into KBOO in 2010 with the Old Mole Variety Hour, which I was super active in for at least 5, 6, 7 years. And then over the last 5 years, I have had to pull back because of family and work.
But what drew you to KBOO originally?
I mean, the fact that KBOO is a community-driven institution. It's almost all entire volunteer-ran, and I know it's controversial what happened with layoffs and everything, but I think that aside, the fact that KBOO is an organism that is created by people coming together to build what they want, in this case, a community radio station and all the kinds of content that it hosts, is so inspiring. That's the kind of world we want to live in. It's embryonic of the kinds of institutions that should be what we call society, of people coming together in voluntary associations to make things happen that they want to be in the world, and through the synergy of their capacities, actually make it easier for people to have access to these things, and it not be this zero-sum game of we're doing something to sell to people, and so only the people who have money are going to get it.
Yeah, no, I got into KWU because, you know, as when I first moved to Portland in 1985, and I got into all kinds of activism. It was just there. It was, you know, they were the ones who were, you know, they're on their news, on their public affairs. I can't even remember what the kind of talk radio back way back then. But yeah, they would talk about the kind of stuff. You know, we would do whatever we would do. You know, there's a vibrant Central American solidarity movement going on because of these vicious wars in Central America, totally supported by the United States. Of course, the forest protection movement. There was all kinds of stuff going on. Anti-nukes was still going on. And you know, KBOO, there was, you know, the Alliance newspaper was going strong then. And KBOO, and, you know, very few other independent sources. And they kind of reflected what we were doing and amplified it. And so, yeah, I was able to get involved and do the same thing. Yeah, it's just hard to, I think we really need to get back to our roots in a way and really realize how incredibly rare and precious what KBOO is doing still is.
Yeah, I mean, and the saying is hope springs eternal. And in a certain way, like, it seems like that's in the past and it's disconnected, but it's always with us. People are always making choices and making society happen, and we are constrained to make a certain kind of society happen. And KBOO has been a example of how people can come together and create a space to create the possibility for a different kind of society. And that's always with us if we are able to realize it. And I don't want to boil things down to kind of individual realization, but it's up to us as individuals to make that connection between, like, this is my life and this is what I can be doing with it, and this is what we can do together that, like, I can't do on my own.
Totally. No, I'm so glad you, sorry kind of to track your conversation into this, but it is a reality. We are in our end of membership drive, and that is how we keep going. We are a listener-sponsored organization. 56 years we've been going on, and no, it's wonderful to have this conversation because it kind of brings me back to feeling, you know, those feelings that I had initially, and sometimes you, I don't know, sometimes it's hard to get those feelings about exactly what it is, this kind of community project, you know, it can inspire us and keep us going in difficult times, which we are definitely in. Anyway, so maybe you can just stick me with to the end of the hour, unless you have to go, which would be fine. But I just want to remind people this is our end of the membership drive, and the way to support what Joe and I are talking about, what you're listening to right now, KBOO, is go to kbo.fm/give, or just go to kbo.fm and click on the donate button, or you can text KBOO to 44321, 44321 on your mobile device, or you can mail it in to KBOO, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. I didn't mean to hijack your morning here, Joe, but it just seemed like a great opportunity to talk to another KBOO person about KBOO.
Yeah, I think that KBOO is a form, is trying to create and has been successful in creating a form of the commons. We create a media commons for people to come into the station or get involved with the station and learn how to make radio, have access to the means of production of making music accessible to folks over broadcast, of making talk like this available to people over broadcast, of making community conversations happen in a broadcast medium that can capture, you know, the attention of tens of thousands of people all over the region, all over the world. And that we ask for money because of the world that we live in and that there are bills to pay, but it's not like KBOO is making anybody money. We are giving the world far more than we receive from it in terms of value. And that is, I think, the prize that we have to keep our eyes on, is that ultimately this is about transcending this transactional relationship. But we are in the world we are in, and so we have to ask for the bare minimum to keep that, to keep the doors open, as they've said over the years.
Indeed.
And I'll just say that, like, I've loved the bit that people have used over the years of how much to give, and, you know, if you can give 1 hour of your hourly wage, if you're an hourly wage worker, a month, and that's all, that's huge for KBOO. And you can, in your day, in your week, in your month, like, if you're having a hard time,
that's
got to
be,
know,
the,
I'm just gonna,
that's got to be the last word.
My KBOO hour.
That's got to be the last word.
Because
we are out of time. Thank you, Joe. It's wonderful talking to you. Support KBOO, everybody. And thanks, everybody, for calling in and listening. Signing off for now. This is Paul Rowland. Bye-bye.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 9 a.m.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
You're listening to KBOO's Catalog of Connections, year-end.